As long-time listeners know, the Little Wireless program has crusaded for decades on the idea of giving trees the vote. And today, we look at the politics of trees, but from a slightly different point of view. While many wept watching our forests burn over summer, others blamed extensive national parks, so many damn trees, for making the bushfires worse than they might have been. Types of trees, location of trees, everyone's got an opinion when it comes to fire danger. At the same time, trees, of course, are an essential part of slowing climate change by capturing carbon. But well-informed critics, and I've got a couple on the program, say good money, good opportunities have been wasted when it comes to some tree planting programs. Associate Professor Patrick O'Connor has been looking at exactly that. He's an ecological economist from the University of Adelaide. Welcome to the program, Patrick. And our old friend, Professor David Lindemeyer, has been making headlines this week, making trouble again, saying that forest logging should stop right now to help prevent more fires. Just to remind you, David is an ecologist from the ANU's Fenner School of Environment and Society. And given the context in which this discussion is taking place, I must mention Frank Fenner, who I was proud to know. Frank, a very distinguished Australian scientist in the field of virology, and his two greatest achievements are cited as overseeing the eradication of smallpox and the control of our rabbit plague through myxomatosis. Welcome to you both. Now, David, the burning question after the fires is, do trees exacerbate fire dangers? Let's talk about agricultural land first off.
Well, I think the thing in agricultural landscapes that's really important, Philip, is that the thing that drives fire in those places is wind speed. And the way that we need to dampen our wind speeds in agricultural areas is actually to have shelter belts and tree plantings in the right places. Now, we don't want to plant trees in places that are going to damage buildings and create threats for people in homesteads. So there is farm design here that's very important. But there are ways to solve these problems of fires in agricultural landscapes, and tree planting is a really important part of that.
The Murray-Darling Basin, when Whitefellas arrived, had, what, 20 to 23 billion trees. How many these days, David?
The estimates are around down about 8 billion, so we've lost approximately 15 billion trees from the Murray-Darling Basin, a colossal number in anyone's language.
I know from your work that trees have a big effect on regional climates and rainfall. 2007 study showed that the size of the impact of millennial drought was more substantial in landscapes already heavily cleared.
That's correct. That was work from the University of Queensland led by Professor Clive McAlpine, and that showed that essentially very cleared landscapes did not do well. In fact, they did very badly, more badly than landscapes that had more tree cover.
Pre-drought, we raised Angus cattle at Elmswood, and of course they're black, and it was necessary for people with black cattle to build trees to protect them.
That's correct. There's a real animal welfare issue here in terms of protecting black cattle, in fact, all cattle and sheep from high temperatures, and shelter belts and tree plantings, tree lanes are really important parts of agricultural landscapes, especially ones that have been overcleared. So there's a lot of work to do there to put a lot of trees back in the landscape.
David, let's look at forests and talk first about your research on the Victorian State Forest. They've been logged for many years.
Yes, and what we found there is that forests that have been logged in the past and then regenerated are much more likely to burn at higher severity than forests that have been unlogged. And our latest work looking at East Gippsland fires, as well as fires in 2009, show quite clearly that major logging effect and its impacts on increasing fire severity. In fact, it's actually not just Australia. We see that phenomenon all over the world in a global review that we published more than a decade ago, showed exactly that.
David, I think it's time to remind the listeners of the definitions or the differences between state forests, plantation forests, and national parks.
Yes, that's right. There's different types of what we call land tenure. So plantations are by and large exotic tree species that are deliberately planted to produce timber or for wood pulp. And they might include Tasmanian blue gums in Western Victoria or Pinus radiata in Victoria, New South Wales, hoop pine, which is a native tree but planted as a plantation in parts of Queensland. So that's different from a native forest, which are native eucalypt trees and other kinds of trees that are occurring naturally in the environment. They haven't been deliberately planted for wood production. And that again contrasts with national parks, where in Australia we do not log national parks.
But in state forests there is some logging after natural growth in the hope or the belief of regrowth.
That's correct. So state forests are wood production environments where the trees are harvested or logged and then regrown. And the aim of the game is to come back at regular intervals and take the wood out and then regrow the forest. And what we find is that those wood production state forests are where logging operations increase the risk of high severity fire.
Talking to David Lindemeyer, who's in Canberra, and Patrick O'Connor, who's in Adelaide. Now, data from empirical science shows that many kinds of eucalypt forests are susceptible to high severity burning after logging.
That's correct. So we see that in the wet eucalypt forests in central Victoria, but our more recent work is showing that it's also occurring in dry eucalypt forests, also in Victoria and northeast Victoria. But it's an impact that's seen in other parts of eastern Australia. And there's some other unpublished work by other researchers in Queensland indicating that there are problems with this kind of logging operation in northern New South Wales and potentially southeast Queensland. So it's not just a Victorian issue. It's now much more across the nation's forests that have been targeted for wood production.
David, how does logging or why does logging make the forests more fire prone? And are the fires more ferocious?
Yes, the logging does make forests more fire prone and it does increase the severity of fire. So that means the chance of the fire getting into the canopy of trees and burning at very high severity, but also very high intensity, where intensity is the amount of heat that's produced. And there are several reasons why this occurs. The first one is that traditional, conventional logging operations leave a large amount of logging debris in the forest. That's tree heads.
This is called slash, I understand.
That's correct. And it's material that's not wanted, so it sits in the forest. And it can be over 50% of the original stand of trees.
Branches, debris, bark, etc.
That's correct. That's correct. And that stays in the forest for a year or two. And then about half of that is burnt, but the rest of it remains in the forest. And it adds to the fuel in the recovering stand of trees that are regrown. The second thing that happens is that very important parts of the forest structure, particularly tree ferns, which are the wetter elements of forests, those are lost during logging operations. And so the forest is drying out, plus it has extra fuel in it. And the architecture of the forest has dramatically changed. So you'll often have a wheat field of very young, fast-growing trees that are producing large amounts of fine and medium fuels. So together this makes a really nasty combination of features which makes logged and then regenerated forests much more likely to burn at much higher severity.
Now, before we bring Patrick into the discussion, I just want to understand this. When a forest is young, because it's been cut down and regrown, it burns at very high temperatures because of its density?
Because of its density and because of the extra fuel that's been left in the forest and because of the structure of the forest. And so what we see at the other end of the scale is that fires are far less severe in very, very old forests. And that's what we should be aiming for, is to produce as much old forest as possible where the severity of the fire is as low as possible.
And now to Associate Professor Patrick O'Connor, ecological economist from the University of Adelaide. And Patrick, you have a beef with what I thought at the time sounded pretty terrific, the 20 Million Trees Program. First of all, what was it or what is it?
No worries, Philip. The 20 Million Tree Program was a program started about 6 years ago to plant 20 million trees. There was a budget of about $70 million and the money went to large and small projects with not-for-profit tree planting groups and community groups.
But you're, and as of March this year, what, 18 million trees have been planted?
That's right. About by about now, they'll be pushing towards 19 million.
But you have your criticisms. Give us a hint. You reckon it's not a great use of public money.
Well, the problem with planting... So when we say planting trees, I mean, you have to say, what are we planting the trees for? So we tend to assume a whole bunch of things about what a tree will produce if we plant it. We think that it will provide habitat for species. We think that it will sequester carbon. It may have other catchment effects and amenity, maybe even agricultural benefits. But that only happens if we plant them in such a way as to achieve those benefits. And if we're going for a multiple set of those benefits, then we have to really plan for that. And of course, there's a cost to that. So the 20 million tree program spent relatively little amount on each site. And the amount spent mean that you can get the essentially a low quality revegetation product, so that it will produce essentially a pretty low amount of any of those benefits when more could be achieved.
So 20 million trees doesn't require planting of enough stems or enough different species. So, and with a basic kind of forest like this, you don't actually capture much carbon.
No. So, the people doing the work tend to seek ways to improve it, and they are looking for multiple outcomes. But if you looked at it purely on carbon, most of these plantings would never reach a break-even point. So the amount of carbon that they sequester would not pay for the tree planting, let alone the foregoing opportunity of producing something else on that land, like wool or wheat.
Patrick, tell us about the problems with ongoing management.
So the difficulty in a revegetation program is who's going to take the risks down the line of anything that goes wrong, fire, drought, any of the other problems, insects, etc. And so contracts to make sure that the party that grows the trees shares the right amount of risk are very difficult, because who should be responsible for a problem that's going to occur down the line? So the Commonwealth tends to set up contracts which essentially fairly quickly, within a couple of years, all the risk reverts back to the Commonwealth, and then the tree planters and the landholder themselves bear no real risk, and therefore have no incentive beyond their own interest in the project to see it through to a reasonable outcome.
We're talking the politics of trees with David Lindemeyer and Patrick O'Connor. We've planted thousands of trees at the farm over the last 30 years, but of course they have a high mortality rate, apart from a catastrophic drought or two. You get they're attacked by ferals, rabbits and hares nibble away. All sorts of things can happen to a tree. And I have to say, our mortality rate has been deeply, deeply disappointing. What's the survival rate, do we know, Patrick, of the millions thus far planted?
Well, in the 20 million tree program, the contracts last for an active phase is a couple of years. So you're probably getting 50 to 70% survival in the first year, and then there might be some replanting effort. But after a couple of years, that all moves away. The proponents move away, and the landholder's left with whatever's there. If trees die after that, it's entirely up to the landholder if they seek to replace them. But the other problem is that the density originally planted is not really configured to produce the kinds of benefits that we want, neither carbon nor biodiversity as examples.
Patrick, the media office for the Department of Agriculture, Water and the Environment tell us that in the latest round of contracts, two-thirds of recipients were required to maintain plantings for 10 years, but they admit that nothing happens if they don't.
That's right. So it's very difficult to make somebody take the responsibility for the trees down the line. The landholder themselves, in most cases in this program, receive no financial payment for the trees. So the funds often went to third parties. Once the third party moves away, the landholder couldn't really be held accountable for anything that happens subsequent to that. So, you know, grazing, fire, pet disease or insects. So the difficulty is, you know, when we go out and buy a bit of public road or we make a public investment in roadway, we want the road to work. We want to be able to drive up and down. But when we invest in trees, because there's this confusion about what the quality of the outcome is, we tend to buy a set of trees, and whatever we get, we just say, oh, well, I'm happy with that. But we're using resources here with the intention of achieving biodiversity conservation or carbon sequestration, but we're not really getting it.
Patrick, it sounds a little bit like greenwashing. It sounds as though, well, it's a, something you can do to make it look like you're doing something.
I think it's a very cynical greenwash in this case. It's about demonstrating that 20 million trees sounds big, sounds like a lot. 20 million trees actually doesn't spread across very much of the landscape. We looked at if you would put the entire amount of this program, all the funds, into just one threatened ecological community, of which there are 84 in Australia, if you just put it into one of the woodland types that's threatened, you would not move that community out of its threatened of its critically endangered status.
David, do we know how many trees we lost in the last powder fires?
No, we don't. We don't, Philip, but I think one of the key issues here with the fires is that many of the ecosystems that were burnt, in forests particularly, will actually regenerate naturally if we leave them alone. So many Australian trees will re-sprout when they're burnt if they're a suitable age. And so that then becomes a really important issue, because many of these systems will recover. They have the inherent capacity to do that, as long as we don't go and mess with them afterwards. For example, if we log already burnt areas, that will actually significantly impair the recovery process.
Well, you made that point very powerfully in our previous conversation, I remember. But, Dave, back to logging in native forests. If we didn't do it anymore, how would we get paper?
So the issue here is that already 87% of what we log in native forests goes into the pulp and paper and wood chip streams. And so what we're seeing from economic analysis is that we already have sufficient plantations to create the feedstock to make paper. And that exists in Victoria, for example, where there's presently 3.9 million tonnes of eucalypt pulp logs in the state. But we export 2.9 million tonnes.
That's 75%, yeah?
That's 75%. So if we were to retain some of that material in Australia and process it in Australia, we would essentially solve the problem of where we need to get the feedstock to make paper. But in doing so, we would actually increase the number of people that would be employed in regional Australia processing that material. So we would have Australian-grown and Australian-processed material. And as we can see with the impacts of the coronavirus on the toilet paper scam, we're actually producing most of this material in Australia already. And so there is a solution to this problem. Focus carbon storage, water production and tourism in native forests, and focus wood production in plantations, and keep Australian jobs here processing Australian materials.
Well, you've just made the point about toilet rolls. I mean, the whole notion. Everyone in the audience is now totally frozen. You've got them in the palm of your hand, David. So it's a silly economic rationale to export. So we should leave native forests alone to regenerate and, yes, encourage biodiversity.
That's correct. And what we see is that in a Victorian context, again, where we've done the economic and environmental analysis, the state of Victoria will actually be better off financially by making the transition rapidly into plantations and moving away from highly destructive, sort of fire-encouraging native forest logging. So there are really good positive outcomes to be had here, including employing more people in the forest industry through processing plantation feedstock in Australia. And those logging contractors that would no longer be logging forests could very straightforwardly be converted to becoming elite firefighting crews, which we're going to need lots of, given the kinds of fire conditions that we've just seen, which are going to be replicated in the future.
My producer has just handed me your ASIO file, Patrick O'Connor, and I discovered that you wear another hat. You're chair of the Peak Group for Landcare. It's called the National Landcare Network. Is Landcare as active as it used to be? And is there a bigger role it might be playing?
It's still active, Philip. It's very active. In some parts of the country, there are there are still thousands of land care groups and state organisations in each jurisdiction. And so it's very active, and there's a lot more people being drawn back to land care. There was a bit of a change in scene when particularly Commonwealth governments took up the name of land care and announced programs in the name of land care, but didn't seek to engage the community. But that's changing, and people are coming back to land care as an expression of their concern about their environments, like from recent bushfires, but also a broader production and climate change agenda. And so the movement's growing again, and the intent is to make it a strong force and a strong forum for discussion, learning, innovation, and adapting to climate change.
David, let's go back to the benefits of leaving native forests alone. I understand that 80-year-old trees are currently being used for saw logs. Is that sensible?
Well, what we know is that optimum saw logs take about 80 to 100 years to grow. The problem is that the amount of fire that we're seeing in forests and how quickly that fire is reoccurring. For example, in East Gippsland now, there are significant parts of East Gippsland that have been burnt two or three or even four times in the last 25 years. So essentially that means that the forests can't grow old enough before being burnt to produce saw logs. So again, we need to be thinking about where can we get the feedstock to run the forest industry to make paper and to make timber. And the answer again is in plantations, because we can grow trees far more quickly, far more productively in plantations in a much smaller land area to get the wood products that we need. And we can harvest a crop well before it has the risk of being reburnt. So it's quite clear what the options are here, and the pathway forward is a good one, and a bigger set of opportunities, an optimistic one, and that's to move our wood production to plantations and do it quickly.
David, water production back in the native forest, as trees grow older and growth slows down, don't they transpire more water?
No, actually the research shows the opposite. What it shows is that young forests, when they're growing very quickly, are fixing large amounts of water and transpiring it into the atmosphere. And the process of transpiring that water slows dramatically as the trees age. So it's essentially like having a household full of teenagers cleaning out your fridge all the time. That's what's happening in a young, very rapidly growing forest. So if you're a water manager and you want to maximise the amount of water that's coming from a water catchment, then you try to manage the forest so it's as old as possible for as long as possible.
Patrick, do we need a bit of national policy direction on all this?
Yeah, absolutely. So much of what David's talking about there is the high value that we place on native forests and the opportunities that exist for the economy of moving away from extraction towards a broader perspective on what the value of those things are. And then programs like the 20 Million Tree Program would add real value, because they would be adding high-quality assets into the landscape. But we need a policy agenda for that. And, you know, the greenwashing approach is just running out of time to make useful contributions. And those landholders involved will see that in a few years' time. They'll see whether what they got was what they intended to get.
David, if you were writing a policy paper for the federal government, and perhaps you are, you certainly should be, what would it say?
It would be a policy response at several levels. The first one is that we need to create the methodology to allow carbon capture to be a key industry in native forests and other environments. So to create the opportunities for employment, for having people on the ground to manage those key assets. The second thing we need to do is to have that carbon methodology transferred also into the agricultural environments to encourage farmers to have more trees on their properties, but in ways that lead to better biodiversity outcomes, better carbon storage outcomes, better productivity outcomes. So we need the policy directive, we need the methodology and infrastructure there to really think about these new opportunities in the new economy, and carbon storage and land management and fire management are key parts of those policies, and we need leadership, we need direction on this.
And of course we need to give trees the vote. I'm sure you both agree with me on that. Gentlemen, I thank you. Professor David Lindemeyer ecologist from the ANU's Fenner School of Environment and Society, and to you, Associate Professor Patrick O'Connor, who's an ecological economist from the University of Adelaide. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to the team. You've been terrific. It's been a very busy week. And if we all don't catch the virus, we'll be back next Monday. See you then.